Blog Talk Radio.
We have here a Suspense Radio Inside Edition. Today is April the 16th, 2016, when we are playing this show live. So however, wherever, and whenever you listen to the show, we want to thank you. Of course, you can subscribe to us on iTunes. That's the fastest way to make sure that you get all of the shows right into your listening device. So you can listen to them whenever you are wanting to do it, on the treadmill, running, going to the store, whatever it is, we have something for you here on the Suspense Radio Network. Make sure you check out all of our other four shows, including Crime and Science Radio, The Story Blender, Beyond the Cover, and One-on-One. We always have a little something for everyone in this genre. Today we are going to have 90 minutes of fantastic authors. We're going to kick it off with Deborah Goldstein, followed by Adam Mitzner, and then Kennedy Quinn will all be on the show today talking about their books. Well, we want to remind you that all the shows here are also brought to you by Kensington Books. Make sure you visit kensingtonbooks.com to see their new releases with their authors, like Kevin O'Brien and Lisa Jackson, just to name a few. There's another great book they have out called Dark Homecoming that I really want to make sure that I get a hold of that and check it out because it's fascinating. I love Kensington's style of horror and mystery along with cozies and things they have going on, so they're doing some fantastic things. Check them out. We're going to be back with One-on-One tomorrow. Story Blender hit last night, so make sure you check that. That was David Corbett on there with Stephen James. That was a fantastic interview also. But now let's jump into the show. We have our first guest. She is the author of her latest book. It's called Should Have Played Poker. It's going to be a new series. We think it's going to be a new series. It's a Carrie Martin, the Mahjong Players mystery coming, but then there's some dynamics that are heading into it. So we want to welcome Deborah onto the show. So thanks so much for coming on. How you doing?
Hi, how are you? It's good to be here today.
I'm doing John. Fabulous. Again, thanks so much for coming on. It was great that, I get these things emailed to me from publicists and different people, and then I always kind of look, and I get about 40 or so a day, and then I kind of sift through, and I see the interesting facts that I can kind of jump into. And when I got the email and I started looking, I was like, oh, this is kind of different because I've never seen a mystery series kind of take on these kinds of dynamics, Should Have Played Poker, have a little Mahjong in there, things that I kind of understand. So tell us a little bit about the book here that you have coming out, and again, we'll kind of get into, is it a series or not a series, or what's going to happen? That's another mystery.
Well, in this book, the protagonist is Carrie Martin. She's a young lawyer who is balancing her corporate law job and visiting her father, who lives in the Sunshine Retirement Home. He's a former preacher in the early stages of dementia. But the key is that her mother, who abandoned the family 26 years earlier, comes back on a certain day. She arrives and she leaves Carrie surprised with a sealed envelope and the confession she once considered killing Carrie's father. Before Carrie can find any answers as to her own past, her mother is murdered in the Sunshine Village retirement home that the father lives in. Now, Carrie's instructed to leave the sleuthing to the police, but she quickly finds that she's at odds because the detective assigned to the case, Brian McPhillip, just happens to be her former live-in lover. And there's also the others who want to help her, who she finally does take into her confidence, shall we say. And her co-sleuths are the Sunshine Village Mahjong players, i.e. the pink-haired ladies of the Sunshine Village. So together they attempt to unravel the Wahoo, Alabama's past secrets. And it's a fast-paced, cozy mystery because Carrie soon finds herself not only in danger, but she finds that the truth and integrity she was always taught aren't what she was led to believe.
Mm-hmm. Now, this isn't the first book that you wrote, but this is, you know, again, the start of something different. You know, you're introducing a new character, and you're coming out with a little bit different kind of style and things that you've had in the past. So what was it about? Was it Carrie that kind of pulled you in? What was it, the idea of kind of going this direction, maybe with these plots and these things? How was that dynamic when you decided to write the book, Should Have Played Poker?
There were two things, John. As you know, I was a sitting judge at the time I started writing this, and my first book, Maze in Blue, had been a murder mystery set on the University of campus of Michigan, where I had gone and done my undergrad. So I had some background there. This, I wanted to write about a young lawyer, but the irony was I went to – when Maze in Blue came out, you know, you do the circuit, and I was at a conference in Wetumpka, Alabama. I was a panelist. I fell in love with the city. But more importantly, they asked all the authors to auction off the name of a character in their next book. A bidding war ensued to be in my next book, and a woman bought the character's name, and I was so excited. It was the first time this had happened to me. And I started talking to the woman. I enjoyed her so much, and all of a sudden a sentence came into my mind, and I said, I'm going to combine my background of being a young lawyer with what I think about this lady, and I think I'm going to make a tale, taking things I know and adding, we won't call Wahoo Wetumpka, but a lot of the physical things I saw. You know, the old, when you're in Alabama, the old courthouses, the old stone, marble feelings of settings, all of it came together, and all of a sudden I had the beginning of a book, and then I started thinking about what were things that were in my life or that people had told me that I could steal, because what writer doesn't steal good stories, and modify to make into something that would be fun for readers? Because that's me. I write books because, as a lawyer, I was a very boring person who read for fun on airplanes. And the kind of books I read were this kind of cozy type or traditional with cozy elements. They read fast and they're fun. And that's what I wanted to put together, and that's what I aimed for.
So it's safe to say, of course, that the setting of the book, and a lot of authors are doing this, and you see a lot of this. I mean, I guess it was more, and I always try to realize, you know, when kind of did this kind of dynamic maybe start, that the setting was kind of character for itself. Of course, Stephen King did it a lot with Derry, and, you know, he did it with, I can't remember the other, Castle Rock, and he kind of had the setting kind of create its own character, and now those things are kind of coming around, and it's being a little bit more popular. So since it was something that you weren't familiar with, an area that you just fell in love with and you got, how intensively researched did you kind of have to go in and kind of get the underbelly of the town and kind of be able to bring that to life here in the book?
I had to do some. I had to drive around. I had to walk in and out of buildings, but I had to also steal from other places that I had been. In my litigation career, I'd done a lot of southern small cities, and a lot of them have the same town square. They have the same buildings. So I'd been in and out of them for years. Plus, I read other authors who described these towns. Probably the one we all know the best in the South is Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird.
Right.
In your mind, you've never been there in Monroeville, but I bet you can see what the courthouse looked like. And that's
right.
The kind of way I wanted to write. So it was a combination, John, of researching by reading and researching by literally walking in and out of the town. Wetumpka, for example, has a river walk. So I drove down and looked at it. It's not the same river walk that some of the other towns have. It just looks over the water, as opposed to some of these that make it a big deal. But I added things to it. Because I took the seed and then added, because I needed a place for the corporation to be, I needed a place for a garden to be, and so I took from other areas and just moved them and made my own town. Kind of Louise Penny does that in her towns, and I think any good writer steals and then creates a town. You just have to remember where you put the buildings in the last book.
Right, and You know, and that's something, since you're already kind of using a base and you're not building, at least you do have a lot of things that you can, pull from and you can go after, because you're not using, everything from scratch and having to write everything in and fill the whole thing in. But let's kind of get into Carrie as a character. Now, when you decided that you were going to start this venture and you were going to kind of have this new series and have these new characters going on, what was the pull for her? I mean, give us Carrie. Let us know who she is as a person. If she were to be here and we were to talk to her right now, how would she do certain things and ask certain things and answer certain things and get involved in those situations?
Okay, if Carrie was sitting in front of you, she'd be a 29-year-old lawyer. She'd be eager. She'd want to do well. At the same time, she'd be naive in many ways. She'd be a person who goes to the gym, a person who spent a lot of time with her dad, a person who's made a conscious decision to stay in her small town right now while her dad is still able to recognize her. At the same time, Carrie would be a determined young woman, because she made a decision in her life. She started out to be a police officer, and she actually was almost halfway through the academy when she decided that wasn't for her. Her boyfriend, Brian McPhillip, went on and became a policeman and then a detective, where she decided law school was a better fit because she felt that she could give back to people in a better way that way. So she's a woman who does make decisions. At the same time, she makes decisions when they tell her to stay away and let the sleuths be the formal detectives. She knows that if they're not going to follow up, she's going to. So she is somebody who will stick her nose in. And at the same time, one of the other factors is she's going to learn and grow in the book, because just like any 29-year-old or a child or an adult, we all learn from our interaction with others. And if Carrie was in front of you, she'd probably be checking out the radio station and probably figuring out what she could learn and maybe what she could do from it later on.
Mm-hmm. And was it that pull that said she would be the right one to kind of front this new venture for you?
Yeah, I think so, because I felt that, and let me go a little bit both ways. Carrie was a young lawyer. I wanted to write about a young lawyer. I wanted to have her be the serious character in the book. At the same time, the reason I brought the Mahjong players, they had been in a short story, my first one that was ever published, Legal Magic, and they were funny. They had different characteristics. They're quirky. Carrie needed comic foil, because at 29, you're sometimes very, shall we say, serious or focused, and you don't always recognize the humor in things. They brought it in, and they pull it out of her. At the same time, I wanted it to be different. I was fortunate enough to grow up with a happy childhood, a mother and father who loved me and all that, which is very boring when you look at it for a book. So I wanted to think
about...
Yeah,
it is, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I just told you my whole life story in one sentence, right?
Yeah, there it is.
But what if I switched it? What if mother had not been there? What if I hadn't been loved, or I hadn't felt that I had been loved, even though there might have been a community trying to raise me? What would that have done to me internally, and how would that have made me respond to external forces, which is like your last question? It would have made me resilient, probably, but it still would have made me a little doubtful about things. And I wanted to bring all that in, because Carrie's got a good job with a corporate law firm. She's got good things going, but she also has her own insecurities. So I wanted to do all that, and I wanted her to be the protagonist, because that was a character I felt could grow on in the series.
Well, and nothing like, having Carrie visiting her father, and then all of a sudden, after 20-odd years, her mother shows up and gives her an envelope talking about how she once considered killing Carrie's father. I mean, you kind of threw her right into the fire right at the beginning. Why did you kind of decide to kind of go that way? Did you just want to give her off with a bang? You want to just throw her right into the fire and get her going right from the outset?
Pretty much. I figured that if I just started telling you about the law office or just about the retirement home, it would be dull. If something happened, there'd be conflict immediately. And we as readers want conflict. We want to enjoy a book, and we don't want to be bored. So I felt that, as you know in the beginning, I think the way the book opens, it starts comically, I hope, to capture you. The first time I thought of killing him, the two of us were having chicken sandwiches at that fast food place with the oversized rubber bird anchored to its roof. That's the mother talking. I would hope that that paragraph itself would capture you because of two things. One, you know a lot of those fast food type restaurants, so you'll giggle because you've been there. And secondly, right. How many people think about killing somebody's father? That is a emotion that doesn't happen every day. So I would hope the reader would want to read on, and I hope they would also see that my sense of humor is in the book because I can't write anything that doesn't have some humor in it.
Now, I want to remind everybody here that we are speaking with author Deborah Goldstein, and you can visit her website at deborahhgoldstein.com. The book actually drops on April the 20th, so you can go and you can pre-order it now through Amazon, and then you'll have the Kindle. It's $3.99, and you can pre-order it through Amazon right now. But now, the one theme that you kind of have, and it is a cozy. I mean, this is a cozy, kind of book. But the one thing that you did, and you did two things that are a little outside the cozy realm, but which is very intriguing because you kind of brought it in. First thing is that you have a main character that has a professional job. Normally they're like, the cheese shop owner or the flower owner or something a little bit different where they're not really involved in the law and they kind of get thrust into it. So that's a little different. And then it is kind of you kind of have that dark past with the mother and Carrie and the pole and all that going on. So how difficult was it to weave those kinds of things together and still make it that cozy mystery that, fans love to read because it is that quick read of a little, like about 250 pages?
It was difficult in the sense that when I first started it, it was too heavy. I had to go back and I had to
soften it,
make it easier. She has I won't say she has the darker side to her, but she has the serious side. I couldn't write her as a cheese shop owner because Carrie wasn't. She had to have a profession. She had to be a person in her own right. At the same time, just like any cozy, she had to grow. So she can't be perfect. She's a novice in the law world. She's not a partner. She's not a high upper. She's learning. All of us who start in law, we all remember, I started in corporate law. I was doing international tax for one of the national corporations. And we're peons. We don't know what we're doing. We have a law degree. But we do have enough, as she does, to understand if something's not quite right. And I think I made her a professional, but I didn't make her so high that a common reader couldn't find her. Everybody can identify with her and can either be rooting for her or rooting against some of the characters in the book. They'll recognize their mothers, their sisters, their friends, and the pesky neighbor down the street type of person. They're all there. So it is a cozy, but you might say it's traditional with a lot of the cozy elements because it does give you suspense and it does give you a little of everything. At least
well,
I hope it does.
Let's talk a little bit about the secondary characters, the one that, create the depth of the story and the depth of the setting. Pick out a couple that you feel that you thought, ended up becoming a lot more, have a lot bigger voice, a lot bigger throughout the book than maybe you thought they were going to have when you were cultivating the story.
Okay. The two characters that I think of immediately, obviously, the Brian McPhillip, the detective, I originally thought he was just going to be a throwaway. He's her former boyfriend, so there was a possibility that sparks could fly again, but I didn't expect them to smolder and then to have a little jealousy enter the picture when the Mahjong players are pushing a lawyer son who's a widowed attorney at her. The Mahjong players think she would be a good catch for one of their children. So I thought the dynamics, I never thought I'd have three characters of the legal field thinking together. The other characters that were really important and became even more important were of the Mahjong players. Originally, I thought the whole group would be equal. They each had a quirk, and I thought Heidi Shapiro, who's the ringleader, who has matching pink hair and pink nails and pink lipstick, would be the key player. But other than pushing her son, she becomes a key role, but it was some of the other ones I liked better. There's a character named Ella, who is a free spirit. She says at one point, or they say about her, that she's been like this since she had a stroke. But in reality, they also say, she's been like this forever, as long as it was me, me, me. Everybody thinks she's a little out of it, but every few moments she comes up with a right-on-point line that you know she's actually picking up a lot more, and she's actually steering Carrie in ways that Carrie hadn't even thought about, and yet she's the one that Carrie should probably discount the most if she was to listen to everybody else. So those were some of the characters I liked best, McPhillip and the Mahjong players. But I think that if you put them all together, they all make a complex community, and that's the beauty of a cozy, that it is community. And that is what I think I did achieve and should have played poker.
Now, I've teased a kind of, you know, at the beginning of the interview that this could be a series. This could not be a series.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because I know that a lot of fans don't really understand the behind the scenes maybe of the book world, and even maybe some authors don't really get it until it happens to them. This might, you know, this, I'm sure this is probably a new experience for you. But what do I mean, and I'm going to let you explain it, when I say this could be a series and it could not be a series?
This was written with the intent of being a series. It could still be a series if it is picked up by a different publisher. It has been orphaned. And Five Star Publishing, who's been great to work with, is a division of Cengage, which is a division of another parent company. They have decided to drop their mystery line in 2017. Normally, after a book came out, they would bring out a book in a year in a series. They bought this book at the very end of 2014. They'd already filled their 2015 catalog, so it was they bought it with the idea it would be in the early part of their 2016 catalog. And they teased me to go back and quickly start writing the next one in the series. They made the decision a few months ago that they're going to stop publishing their mystery line in the middle of 2017. They're not buying any new books. So this becomes an orphaned book because it has no future publisher. A different publisher could pick it up, and because two things happen when this happens. You either already own the rights, which I do for these characters. I only sold the one book. Or you have to get your rights back. I'm luckily not in that position. I'm able to go forward. Some publishers, if they take on the series, will want me to jump it forward a few years, or maybe to emphasize a different character more. Other authors will be orphaned, and they'll just be writing other books, other things. Or they'll decide that they want to take a book like this because there's public demand for it and they want to self-publish or go in that route. I'm still in the stage. I don't know where I'm going to go with it. Right now, I'm very much in favor of this book because I think it has a lot of potential.
And now, are you already thinking, this book has been, you know, you've had this done for, you know, 9 to 12 months. So you probably already have book two and things in the works. I mean, so is that already completed? I mean, are you thinking in the lines that this will be a series and it will come out regardless of maybe the publisher or how it's going to happen, but it is going to happen?
I'm hoping it will. I have the second book in my mind out. You know, I have it outlined and it's not finished yet. I started writing another book that could be another series that is in revision right now. So I'm caught between the two. I will probably be pitching that one at the same time that I'm finishing a second one for this. I'm hopeful that the demand for the characters will be such that people will want to see another book. The reviews and such already have been very good for this, and I think people are going to find it fun. That's what the reviewers are saying. I hope you did when you got a chance to look at it.
Yeah, I mean, and that is the great thing because, you know, I love cozy books because I've always been a fan of Agatha Christie. I love Murder, She Wrote. And I love and sometimes, you know, and I'm about 50-50. Sometimes I go in with the intent, like, okay, I'm going to see if the author can fool me. And sometimes I just go in with, I'm just going to read it and just going to let it happen. Not going to sit there and try to guess about who done it or what's going on. And I think that's, and it is. I mean, it's only like 250 pages. It's not that long to where you can almost, you know, read this in a day and sit down and just, you know, get through it and be entertained more than a lot of the crap that's on the TV. So I would love to kind of, you know, see how you're going and how it's going into the future. But one quick question before we go is, why did you decide to start another series instead of this one? What was it, again, was it the characters you wanted to explore, or did you just think that the story that you wanted to be that you wanted to tell would not fit in here with Carrie?
The story I wanted to tell was a completely different one, in that as I was selling this book and pitching it, some folks had said to me that if you're going to write a cozy, you really should get something like those, that cheese shop or the food or something.
Right.
And my problem, John, is I'm a cook of convenience, you know. So then I started thinking, wouldn't it be funny to have twins? Because I'm a mother of twins, one of whom becomes a professional chef, and one of whom becomes the cook of convenience. So for the heck of it, I started scrawling, and the next thing I knew, just in a few weeks, I had the first draft of a book with those characters, and with recipes like one can make a really good spinach pie, and one can make it out of Stouffer's. One can make,
right,
you know, things of that nature. So that became just a fun aside while I was still working on anything that they needed revised or getting the promo for this. And then I figured I'd go back and get the second book of this series finished. So
gotcha. That
was the whole idea, because I also knew that I had a publisher who was only going to do a book a year.
That's true, too.
So my deadline wasn't up yet.
Well, I'll tell you what, Deborah, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure. Wish you nothing but the best. Look forward to talking with you in the future, and good luck.
Thank you.
To see what happens. So keep pushing along.
Well, I definitely hope the Mahjong Players and I will be back to see you again in the near future. Take care.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So again, everybody, that is author Deborah Goldstein, and you can go to DeborahHGoldstein.com for more information here of her book, Should Have Played Poker. It is book one in the Carrie Martin Mahjong Players Mystery Series, and let's just hope that there's going to be more. It's a fascinating read. I think you'll enjoy it, especially fans who love cozies, just love mysteries in general. Like I said, it's about 250 pages, and you can just get right in, and you can just devour yourself into it, and boom, there it is. We're going to take a short little break. We're going to be back here with our next guest. Very excited to talk to Adam Mitzner. In 2012, we had said that, his book, A Conflict of Interest, was one of the best books of 2012. We've talked to him a little bit. I've never talked to him on the radio before, so it's going to be great to be able to speak with him. And we are going to have that coming up right after this. It's so easy Again, everybody, welcome back here after the break. It's been great to be able to be with you again today here on April the 16th. Again, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, get every podcast right into your listening device. So you can listen to them whenever you do, whenever they're done. They just jump right in there. It's an amazing kind of technology that you should really try out. Let's jump in here to our next guest. Again, he is author Adam Mitzner, and his latest book is called The Girl from Home. Back in 2012, A Conflict of Interest, which was his first book, we here at Suspense Magazine labeled that as one of the best books of 2012. He has since written three more, A Case of Redemption, Losing Faith, and now the latest one, The Girl from Home. So we're excited to be able to get Adam on the show here. So, Adam, thank you so much for coming on, and how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, John.
So like I said, you know, we found out about you in 2012, and now we're great to be able to see you here in 2016 with your fourth book out, The Girl from Home. So let's just jump into it and give us the skinny on what you got going on.
Well, The Girl from Home, like my other books, is at its heart a story of redemption. The main character is a guy named Jonathan Cain, and unlike the characters in my other books, he is not a lawyer, but an investment banker. And he kind of lives the life that people imagine, various apartment, trophy wife, house in the Hamptons, $200,000 automobile. And what the story does is it takes you through his rise and fall with the question whether he can rise again. And most of it is set in a fictionalized version of my hometown, East Brunswick, New Jersey, which I call East Carlisle in the book. And the action moves forward because he goes to his 25th high school reunion, and there he finds the prom queen, and they start a relationship, which is very tangled because she is married. And at the same time, he's back home to care for his ailing father. So there's a lot of stuff going on in the story. And I don't like to rank my books, but so far it's the one that I enjoyed writing the most, at least.
Now, and that's kind of interesting because you jumped out of, and you know, first of all, East Brunswick, I mean, my dad went to Rutgers in New Brunswick. I have a lot of family in New Jersey, so we're kind of close there already, which is good. But why then, and do you feel that you like this? Was it because you jumped out of your law kind of safe goat and you decided you were going to kind of go into a different realm? I mean, even though, of course, you know, your main character in the book is still a very professional person, Jonathan, it's still a very professional field, you know, from law to financial banking, whether it's physician, but it's a professional thing. Why was that? Why did you decide to, you know, to kind of take that leap? And you think that that was part of the reason why you feel this was like your most favorite book?
Well, there's a lot of answers to that question. First is, it's not a legal thriller like my others in the sense that there's not a big trial in the book. But it still has a lot of legal components to it, and I don't think I'm giving away too much when I say that there's a murder in it. And so part of the story is
certainly
a murder mystery.
No, wait a minute. Hold on. We got to stop there. There's a murder in the book? No, I'm just joking.
Yes. So in that regard, it still has elements of law. And in fact, for people who follow my books, the main character of my first book, The Conflict of Interest, Alex Miller, reappears in this book as a high school friend of the protagonist, Jonathan Cain, and provides legal services. So there's still a legal bent to it. But I think that one of the things I set out to do in writing it was to try to tell a different kind of story that didn't rely on the suspense of a trial. And I enjoy that, and it's something I know pretty well because I am a trial lawyer during the days. But I wanted to see if I could put together a book which just doesn't have that kind of ending the way my first three books did. And so I was very pleased that with the way The Girl from Home came out. The reason why it's probably my favorite of the books isn't because it doesn't have the legal trial scene, because I do really like writing those scenes, and I think that they work really well in the books. Probably the reason I like this the best was it tells kind of a bigger story, I think, than my other books, because you see a guy who has it all and then loses it all, And then he goes back, really back home again, and reestablishes a relationship with his father. And you can kind of see, and while I was writing it, there's this sense about how did it all turn for him? Why did he become the person that he became? And then also the bigger question, which I think is a question everybody wrestles with at a certain time in their life, is it too late to change? Can you be a better person? Can you live the kind of life that would make you happier? Or is there a time when you're just kind of hardwired to be who you are? And that, to me, is the underlying question that follows you through the book.
Hmm. Kind of, even though you had the elements you still of the legal stuff, you still had to kind of cultivate a book in a much different way, like you said. I mean, it was much different than kind of your first three. So what were the challenges when you set out, decided to do this? Did you challenge yourself that you wanted to, you know, do something that fans were definitely going to know the difference, maybe in the writing style or how you approach things emotionally, the things that you did, you know, character-wise or the development that you decided to kind of go with? Did you kind of think about all those things on the onset when you were doing it, or did things just kind of come organically and you really didn't, you know, have that that thought process when writing the book?
I would say both. On the one hand, I knew at the outset that it wasn't going to have a big trial at the end. That was one of the kind of, I don't do very much outlining or plotting before I start writing, but that was the one thing that I had in mind. This will be a departure from the other books because it's not going to rely on a big trial scene at the end. The other thing that I knew at the outset was that my protagonist wasn't going to be, for lack of a better word, likable at the very beginning, at least. And mm-hmm. I knew that was going to be a challenge both in the writing and for readers because, you know, you see him and he's a typical what people think of as the worst image of a Wall Streeter. You know, very materialistic, doesn't care about people, doesn't care about relationships. And so I knew that there'd be somewhat of a challenge to having people be invested in what's going to happen to him because you don't necessarily think he's great right at the very, very beginning. But for me, I always liked that kind of a story. I like the story of a main character who's flawed, even in a way that pushes you over the edge of non-likability if you think that there's some sort of redemption that's possible. And the fact that the character himself is struggling with that, I think also heightens the drama quite a bit. The other thing, too, was because I'm a practicing lawyer, I deal with a lot of people in the investment banking world. I have a lot of cases involving investment bankers. And so it allowed me to look into that world more than I had in the previous books. And one of the things I hope people like about my books is, and one of the things I really like when I read other authors, is the extent to which you're getting a little education into a particular area of the world. And so in my books, the straight legal thrillers, the first three books that have a lot of trial stuff, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I think if you're not a lawyer should be interesting to you because it's accurate. And I try really hard to make sure that the evidentiary rulings are accurate and the way that everybody kind of deals in a trial situation is on point. And so here, I think that there's a little bit of insight into what it's like to be an investment banker and how those guys go about their world and the risks and rewards that they face. And so I think that's just another thing to look at, which is different from big law firm life.
Absolutely. And, you know, the one thing, too, is the intriguing character, of course, of Jacqueline Williams, the girl from home. So when you're cultivating and you're creating her as a character, and, of course, you know, you're talking years later after he comes back, Jonathan comes back, that is, and runs into Jacqueline, who, like you had mentioned just in the synopsis, saying that she really didn't have the time for him back in high school, but then all of a sudden, you know, boom, it's a much different kind of situation. Was that personal experience maybe you're kind of pulling from, you know, kind of when you go back and you kind of see those people that maybe you didn't know too much in high school and then things are different? But, you know, Jacqueline in particular, about her character, give us a little bit of background on her.
Well, it's funny because, like I said, because it takes place in the town that I grew up in, I've had quite a few emails from folks that I went to high school with saying, is that who Jacqueline's based on? Is she based on this girl or this woman? And so I always respond by saying, no, it's a fictional account. But I think that it's an experience pretty much everybody can relate to. You're in high school, and it's such a defining time in, I think, everybody's lives. And then you go out and become the person you're actually going to be. And now, particularly with Facebook and the like, you can stay in touch, you know, kind of from a distance with the folks you went to high school with. And obviously, as adults, you don't play into that high school mentality anymore. And yet I think, at least for me, there's a part of you that still always does. And so, you know, on the one hand, like sometimes I'll get an email or a Facebook post from a writer that I really respect, and they'll say, I read your book and I really liked it. And, you know, that's just incredible praise. It's also incredible praise when, you know, somebody you went to high school with who was the prom king or something says, oh, I'm a big fan. And I'm like, well, that's great, because I was afraid to even say hello to you in high school. So I think there's that kind of, you know, everybody has there are celebrities in the real world and you're like excited to meet them. But I think we all knew that in high school there were celebrities there too, and you kind of felt the same way about them. And so in this way, it was funny to see how both perspectives are, because on the one hand, Jonathan is saying, I was kind of a non-entity in high school, and now I'm with the prom queen. And Jackie is saying, gosh, high school was just such a long time ago. I don't think about myself as being the prom queen. And so I thought both perspectives are kind of interesting. And I actually thought for a brief second about reaching out to, you know, the prom queen of my high school and saying, what was it like to be the prom queen? And I decided, yeah, I don't want to do that. It would be easier just to imagine it than to actually base it on anybody in particular.
Right. There's a lot of things you could pull back from high school and a lot of people we could pull from. I mean, you know, that's just from thinking back, I mean, you can always do all those things. But why did you make and why did you decide possibly now, and I don't know if you're thinking about it, but, you know, you have not jumped into the series realm. I mean, your books are all standalones, and even though you brought a character from one of your books and into this one, I mean, you haven't really, you know, been into the series route that way. Why is that?
You know, it's something I think about, and it's one of the first questions that people ask me. Particularly when I say that I've written four books, they say, well, are they a series? Do I need to start at the beginning? And the true reason why I haven't continued any of the characters is because, at least in my mind, what I'm trying to write about in each story is a real arc of, you know, a transformative experience that the character has that really alters them. And so In my view, to pick up another story right afterward with that character, you know, it's almost like the TV show 24 that I was a big fan of. After a while, you start to say, how can this one guy have these many days where he's thrust in the center of saving the world? It just doesn't make sense that kind of thing would happen to him. And I kind of feel the same way about the main characters. In my books, they go through such a fundamental transformation about who they are rather than just pick up another story. I also think, and this is kind of something I grapple with a little bit, traditionally, at least the series that I read and that I like, you have a character who, you know, if it's a lawyer, let's say, the book itself might revolve around the case and the character's view of the case, but the main character isn't necessarily, you know, part of the case. He's more of an outsider looking in. And, you know, in the good ones, the case obviously affects him. But I think what makes series so great is you know this character, and this character is going to kind of be more or less the same in all the books. And so, and in my books, what I'm trying to achieve is that the character isn't the same from the first page to the last page. So in that way, it's a little bit different. And because my protagonists, whether they be lawyers or bankers, are normally the center of the issue that's going on. So they're defendants in the case, or they're accused of a crime, rather than the lawyer representing the accused. All that being said, now it's been, you know, pretty much 7-8 years since, you know, Conflict of Interest came out in 2011, but I was writing it, you know, 2 years or so before that. I feel like it might be time to bring back at least one of the main characters, and they could have another storyline. And that's kind of what I did softly with Alex Miller, because you get to see the life that he's having after a Conflict of Interest, but it's not focused on him in The Girl from Home.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, it's always today's day and age. I mean, 80% of the books you see are out there are part of some kind of a series. And I feel, and Jeff Ayers and I talk about this a lot on our other radio show, is I'm not a big series guy. I mean, I like to know that series have an end. I don't like the open-ended ones that go on for 15, 20, 25 books. I get extremely bored, and I'm really going to probably stop after book 5, because like you said, I just don't see how you could keep writing on the back of the book, this is the most diabolical villain they've ever faced. I'm like, you've written that for the past 17 books. All right, you got to think of something new. So I'm kind of with you on that. I like to know that, you know what, this is going to be a 5-book series, and so now you have a plan, and now I know there's going to be a beginning and an end, and I like to know that maybe in book 5, it might not be all honky-dory, and it might not be all, because life is not sometimes all honky-dory. You know, there's a lot of tragedy that goes on, and sometimes those things happen, and I like to have that sense of suspense and that something like that could happen. So
yeah, I agree
that
with that.
Said,
I think,
though, what?
No, I was going to say, I also think that from the writing perspective and also from the reader perspective, the fact that it's not a series opens up the possibility that, you know, your protagonist could die on page 100, and then the story
right.
goes somewhere else. And you just don't have that when you know that this character has appeared in 11 straight books, because you're pretty sure he's going to appear in 11 more, too, and so it's going to be at least a happy ending, if not, you know, nothing that dramatic is going to happen to the main character because he's got another book to do.
Yeah, I mean, there was a story that came out, you know, many years ago, and you probably have heard about it, where the creator of the story decided, you know what, about 30 minutes into the movie, I'm going to kill the main character. And people are like, are you freaking ridiculous? You can't do that. That you cannot do that. Well, I think it pretty much turned out okay because that movie was Psycho. And those things can happen if they're done in a correct way. And then I think that, you know, it kind of going forward, and I like the fact that you have kind of had those thought processes and you've kind of put those things and you think about them when you're kind of putting them in the book, because then the reader does have that suspense. They don't really know what could happen and how those things could happen.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. You know, I inform a lot of my writing, not only from other books that I read and like a lot, but also, frankly, from television. And, you know, I like, you know, James Bond movies as much as the next guy, but I don't find that they have that kind of element of suspense because you kind of know how they're going to end and that everybody's going to be okay. Whereas, you know, some of the better TV shows, particularly the ones with antiheroes, like, you know, Breaking Bad, for example, you really don't know what's going to happen. And the characters really, you know, they don't have, or Game of Thrones I'm a big fan of as well. You know, you can't stay too attached to anybody because they may not be sticking around for next season. And I think that just makes
right.
for much better suspense, much better drama, and much better storytelling because you don't have any restraints. You can do anything. You can kill off your main character in the first 100 pages if you've got a plan. And, you know, if that's the character that's going to take you through the next 10 books, you can't do that.
Right. So when you're sitting at an event, and, you know, you're sitting at an event that's going to be coming up here, and I'm just going to look at your site here, but, you know, you have an event coming up on April 29th, Murder on the Beach Mystery Bookstore in Delray Beach, Florida. So if people are listening, they can go there And then May 16th, you have another event at Kramer Books and afterwards in Washington, D.C. So when you're sitting there and people come up to you and maybe they're just finding out about you for the first time and then they see The Girl from Home and then they know that you have a couple other books out, then they ask you, well, where should I start with you? What would be one of the books that you say, aside from the new one, maybe, let's just go to the other three and say, this is a good way to kind of find out who Adam Michener is as an author. Start with this one.
You know, it's funny because I don't really have an answer to that. I do tell people to read the newest one. So that is,
right.
And that normally ends the conversation. When they're finished that and they say, you know, which one next, you know, I normally default on saying, why don't you read them in order? So go back to Conflict of Interest. But it's not because I think that's the quintessential Adam Michener book, or even that it's better than the other books, the other three. It's just, you know, you have to start somewhere. So I say, why don't you start there? You know, like anybody, I like to think that my writing is getting better as the books progress. And so, you know, I kind of think, and I think you have to think this way as you're continuing to work, the next book is even going to be better. So in that regard, I don't know which one to point people to. And they're all very personal to me and my favorites in different ways. And so in that regard, like I can tell people, you know, I really like the Conflict of Interest because it was a story that, you know, your first book is one that you think about the most because you're not trying to get another one out a year, 18 months later. So I thought about a Conflict of Interest a lot. There are parts about that book that I just think are great, part of the characterizations, and it's personal to me in the story in a lot of ways. Redemption I really liked a lot, too, because it was Legally Dead, the rapper that's one of the central characters in that. It's one of the better characterizations I think I've done, and so I think that's really exciting. And Losing Faith has a very strong kind of quasi-father-son dynamic between the main character, Aaron Littman, and Samuel Rosenthal, the head of the firm, and I really enjoyed that, and I thought of all the relationships in my books, that's one of the ones that I like the best and I think is really sort of heartwarming. And so there's, to me, there's something to offer in each one of them, and so I try not to rank them too much.
Now, so going forward, and let's kind of look here into the future a little bit, because like you said, you know, your writing is getting stronger. What elements do you think that in the next book people are going to notice different from The Girl from Home? Like, you know, is it going to be, you know, different kind of dialogue? Are you going to try to expand yourself with an author for, you know, scene setting or, you know, emotional conflict or things like that? How do you maybe kind of see your writing going in more into the future?
Well, so I'm finishing up what's the next book at the moment, and it is one that I'm, you know, very, very proud of. I think it's more complicated than the other books that I've written and more shocking at times. You know, I think sometimes the confidence you get with writing and, you know, now you feel like, okay, I know I can write a book. I know that I'm going to have readers who are going to like it. They like what I'm doing. You can take more chances in a way. And so in this book, I think I take more chances, and at least to my mind reading it, they pay off pretty well. There are parts of the book I'm working on now that I think are going to be really shocking to readers. And for me, you know, this next book is about the appearance of a young woman, so it has a little Gone Girl elements to it. And the challenge in writing it is, part of it is in the voice of one of the women, and so there's that challenge, writing in a female voice. Part of it is narrated by a man, though, and it's more psychological, I think, and there's a real shocking twist in the middle.
Gotcha. Well, I'll tell you what, Adam, I want to thank you so much for coming on. We have, like, run out of time here. And quick, like, 30 seconds to kind of – why don't you kind of let everybody know where's the best way to kind of find out a lot of information, everything more about you?
Well, my website is adammitzner.com. I have my email address in the acknowledgments of all my books, and I love it when readers email me, tell me about what they liked about the book, what didn't make sense to them, if that's the case. And so I encourage anybody who reads any of my books to read a page or two into the acknowledgments, find my email, and drop me a line.
Absolutely. Well, Adam, again, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you. Wish you nothing but the best. Look forward to seeing what you have going on in the future. And, you know, just keep on writing, man.
Thank you so much, John. This has been great. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that is author Adam Mitzner. And check him out, adammitzner.com, MITZNER.com, for more information on The Girl from Home, his latest book, which is out now. And you can go back and check out Losing Faith, A Case of Redemption and a Conflict of Interest. We are going to take a short break, and then we'll be back here with our next guest. She is the author of her first book in the Madison McKenna series, mystery series. It's called The Last Best Lie, and it's author Kennedy Quinn. And we are going to be speaking with her right after you listen to this.
Won't you smile a little?
Welcome back, everybody, here after the break. That was Red Zone Rider. You were listening to their great band that I just like to play. You know, I like to play a lot of that metal, 80s, 90s kinds of stuff. And this is a band that kind of came out later, really recent, but it's all that style. So, again, I want to thank the guests here so far that were coming on, Deborah Goldstein and Adam Mitzner. And now we're going to transition into our last guest of the show, 90 Minutes Today. Again, follow us and get us on iTunes, and then you'll get all of the stuff into your podcast. You can listen. It's like over 300 shows we've had and a lot of stuff going on. We need to kind of maybe consolidate this down and put on a CD, and you guys can do it all that way. So Kennedy Quinn is the author here, first book coming out, and it's called The Last Best Lie, and it's a Madison McKinney mystery series. So, Kennedy, thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
Doing great. It's a sunny spring day in Virginia, and I can't think of anywhere I'd rather be than talking about my book. So thanks a lot.
No problem. And it's great that, you know, spring's kind of come. You've turned the corner. Cherry blossom's going to start coming out here in Virginia. Yep. It's a beautiful time in Washington, D.C. in April to go out and see the city, because it is starting to come alive. And you guys had kind of a weird winter, some snow. You had some, you know, some big-time stuff, and now it kind of is all coming out. I mean, let's put it this way. You know, the Washington, D.C. area is just crazy already, but Virginia, it's very pretty state. A lot of historical stuff that goes on there.
Yep.
So The Last Best Lie here is your debut effort. You listed it, of course, as a Madison McKinney mystery book, and that can only mean one thing, that we are going to see Madison McKenna in future books. So let's just jump into it here and tell us about what you got going on.
Absolutely. Thanks. It's a series. I've got a lot of books planned. Basically, Madison McKenna is a female MacGyver, and I hope most people remember MacGyver. He was the guy.
Hell yeah, I remember MacGyver. Yeah. Guy could do anything with a toothpick, a candle wax, and some butane.
So can she. She's a physicist who basically is almost finished with her PhD. She comes from a family of academicians, and she gets everyone upset when she decides, that's it, I'm not going to finish my PhD, and essentially runs away from home to become a private investigator. And she uses her technical talents, she's got some really killer technical talents, to, you know, thwart the bad guys, solve the mysteries, create tools and opportunities, and pretty frequently upset authority figures. I also made her deliberately, as a scientist, I wanted her to be a little different than you see in the stereotypes of scientists. I'm a female scientist myself, and, you know, we're always seeing, especially young girls, think that scientists are nerdy, uninteresting, unfeminine. So I wanted to make certain that my scientist was not only intelligent, witty, interesting, but she was feisty and sassy and sexy. She's got a couple of love interests in the book. One is a bull rider with his pet bull Spinal Snap. And the other is a much older guy.
Well, you are bringing in some awesome 80s reference with the Spinal Snap.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And... yeah, uh-huh. So you're going back to that 80s time. I love it.
Yeah, and she's also got a sort of a much older love interest, where it's a kind of a love-hate relationship, and he really challenges her. And that was actually unintentional, I should say. So one of the fun parts about my book, I will tell you, I very meticulously plan them. I'm OCD. So I sit down and I think about the mystery and I think about all the twists and all the science gadgets and I plan it. And then I start writing it and the characters do whatever they want. And I have to rewrite according to whatever they want. So in particular, one of the love interests in her in the book was really intended just to be a character who came in a book and left. And he was a red herring and, frankly, kind of annoying. And in the middle of the book, in a scene, they started groping each other. And I could not get them to stop. No matter how many times I rewrote the scene, it came back to that. So I gave in, because I guess the character knows her own story, and I wrote him into the scene. And I got to tell you, I think their relationship is one of the most fun that's in there. I have a blast with them. Let me see. So I would also say that, you know, writing science into books is really hard, especially if you want to keep it interesting for the reader. I've kind of got four things I have to do. First, I have to make certain that whatever gadgets or devices or science I use makes sense to someone who's not a scientist but is a logical, rational person and probably knows something
exactly
about it. But then I also have to make certain it's accurate enough so when my colleagues who are scientists read it, it's credible. They know that I know what I'm talking about and I'm not making stuff up because that's really irritating. At the same time, I got to make certain that I write it sort of quickly enough that anyone who's not interested in the why and just wants to get the thing, somebody shot or something blown up or somebody rescued, they can go through it really quickly and not get bogged down. And then the last thing is I have to make certain when I create gadgets or weapons or bombs, I don't do it accurately enough that someone could actually do it in their home because that's your responsibility. I have to do all of that at once. I will say also that I test every device that I use, if at all possible, and legal. Sometimes it wouldn't be legal to get some of the gear.
Right.
I have, that has cost me. I did have a nice little scar in my palm from a wonderful device I made in the second book. I made a taser out of a disposable camera. So you'll read about that in the second book. And the cat jumped up on the table just as I was finishing, so that hurt.
You made a taser out of a disposable camera.
Yeah.
See now, and this is the thing. I think taser. I think electronic. I think you tase somebody and they start falling around like a fish on the ground. Don't get the intricates of a disposable camera, how that would, I mean, I'm just lost at that. So in the book here, and again, this is called The Last Best Lie, give us something maybe that's in the book, something, you know, kind of like you did, that people would look at and go, how do those two things work together? Because that was, I think that when you watch the show MacGyver, and when your publicist emailed me, this is one of the reasons, like I said, I get about 40 of these a day or whatever, and I always sit there and I have to go through them. And your publicist said that Madison McKenna was the female MacGyver. I watched the show religiously. It's on Netflix. I still watch it. I have DVD series of it because I think that the intrigue was not just the character of MacGyver. You never knew what he was going to do and how he was going to get out of the situations because it was fascinating because it wasn't brute strength and it wasn't he could shoot somebody from 200 yards away in a 50-mile-an-hour wind and hit them, you know, center mass. It was different. So how, you know, give us an example in this current book right now of one of those things that is MacGyver-esque that people, that when they email you, are like, are you serious?
Okay. Let me see. There were a couple of examples I used. I created a coffee warmer out of a battery. That's easy. I did create a fire out of some ping pong balls and chewing gum wrapper. A very smoky fire because ping pong balls burn fast and hot if you know how to light them up. And I did have her disable a car by using an old trick of creating a low voltage spark gap device, kind of like old radios would use. And how it works, it's coins in a medicine bottle, and what you do is you expose a circuit to the open air, and she did that by propping open there was a wheel in a car, and it was one of those cars where the key has a chip in it that has to match with the chip in the steering wheel in order for the car to start. It's a very fancy car. And she propped it open, and she got her little spark coil generator and shook it and destroyed the electronics inside the steering wheel. And I took that from the fact that I actually did experience when I was a younger researcher, we kept shorting out our computers on the floor because someone had a habit of walking around jingling keys in their pocket. So that's very straightforward. I also used a device made out of Freon to cut a chain link fence so she could put it over the side of a cliff to rescue somebody.
Oh my God, I'm just sitting here just shaking my head.
And just to satisfy quickly your interest, it's actually easy to make a taser. There's a capacitor inside the
It's funny how you said that. Yeah, it's really quite easy just to make a taser. You just, there you go. No, it's not easy, Kennedy. It's not for dodos like me that read books. We have no idea. That's why we're fascinated.
I could show you how. If we ever meet, I'll show you how to do it.
My God. I'll tell you what. April Fool's Day must be like the greatest day ever at your house because you can just make
Halloween.
Crap and just scare the hell out of people.
Halloween is the best in my house.
Halloween would be another. That was my second choice.
Yeah, I have Halloween. I have hologram ghosts coming out of my front lawn. People
oh,
come
my
from,
Lord.
Yeah. And that's actually fairly straightforward, too. I'll show you how to do that. It has cost me some money, though. If you get a chance to read the book, you'll see at the end she uses a device. She has to use things with whatever's around her. And there was a scene where she's trying to rescue someone. She actually had he was down on the ground. She used a credit card and some lip gloss and a necktie to close up an open pneumothorax in his chest. And now she has to disarm the bad guy. And one of the devices she used is made of condoms and car keys because that's what was in his pocket. So I decided, well, I have to try this to make sure it's going to work. So I did. I went out in condoms and, you got to make car. I have to roll them up from my arm to make sure that they, expand enough. And I put the car keys in them and then roll them back down and sort of tie it like a balloon. So think of it as like a sap. And I'm indoor inside my office and decided that I want to make sure that it's going to hold together. So there's a calendar on the wall, and I decide to throw it at the calendar. The problem is I throw like a girl, and I catch like a blind girl, so I never hit what I throw at. Managed to hit the wall instead of the calendar, and in case anyone doesn't know, lubricant does not wash off of paint. So
interesting to know that.
In case anyone doesn't know. Turns out I had to repaint my entire office. It was kind of mess. But yeah, I was sick of the paint anyway. So, it's not a bad thing.
Go ahead. What I was going to say was that there's so many complex things and, you've done, like you said, car keys and chewing gum wrappers and all these different things that you have going on. But now you have to cultivate a story. And you have to cultivate a mystery and everything that, that is going on. So what was the challenge? It had to almost be the balance of the things that you could have, Madison do, but not overdo because it's still going with, inside a book that, has to go all the way through and make sense to where people are still following the storyline and just not getting involved with the gadget building of what Madison can do?
So that's an excellent question. And, in fact, I'm glad you said that because I don't want people to get the mistake that the science is the star of the show. Actually, the star of the show is completely Madison. And what I'm trying to do is grow her as a person. So every single story has a theme that she has to wrestle with to grow as an individual. She's going to change a lot. The first theme of the first story is about the lies that we tell ourselves that make us believe things we do that maybe we really wouldn't do or shouldn't do. And that's what the last best lie refers to. It refers to the lie that the killer tells himself or herself, I won't say if it's a male or female, that allows him to kill another human being. And Madison doesn't always tell herself the truth. She thinks she does, but there's a lot inside of her that she's not quite willing to admit to. Like I said, she's very intelligent, but she has her own issues. She's got some growing up to do. And so really all of these stories come down to human nature and what is it that humans do to each other inadvertently or advertently, and how does a young woman in her early 20s, who's really stepping out of life for her first time and out of a very sheltered environment. Most of her family were all academicians. And so she's got kind of a sheltered life, and now she's out into the rugged streets of Chicago, and how's she going to handle that? And both grow as a person, yet not lose what is fundamentally her joy of life and her optimism. And she's going to see some pretty ugly things that will change her. And so it really is about a human being. She's got this unique skill. In fact, one of the reasons I also put another element in the plot is she dreams very vividly. So I'm the kind of person who will actually dream the solution to a problem, and many scientists are that way. So I have many dream sequences within the book so that I can even take us out of reality and get very raw about symbolism and let her understand sort of who she is from what kinds of symbols she uses in her life to represent struggles that she's having. So, yeah, thanks for the question, because at its heart, the gadgets are fun, but this is about a human being who's trying to grow up.
Right. And, I mean, and that's, you know, the basis of what you're trying to get across. But, of course, it's great to be able to have the other side things that are in. And you also have, you know, some of the side characters. And one of them is a character called Hunter.
Yep.
Tell us about him.
So Maxwell Hunter is actually the character that I really intended to be a throwaway character, and they started groping each other. And he is in his late 40s, so he's twice her age. He's an extremely wealthy man now, started out as a cop, and was a good cop, but not necessarily a nice guy. And when he was sort of forced out of the police force, his best friend, Jake Thibodeau, is Madison's boss, and so that's how they know each other. And he's got some incidences in his past where he's had difficulty with a woman very much like Madison, and so he does not like her. But at the same time, he's fascinated by her, and he respects her. Even though we've never admit it. And she does not like him, but he challenges her. He gets under her skin. And this sort of this major age gap between them is something that I play with, because my own husband was quite a bit older than I am. He was 23 years my senior. So there was definitely a gender gap there. Working with that and dealing with that, being interested in a guy who's basically her mom's age is also part of the dynamic she's got to figure out. But he also has his own uniqueness. He's more of the James Bond type character in that he's really good at looking like someone else and acting like someone else. And the first time she sees him go from this, you know, completely composed, big football-type looking guy, very in his silk suits, and he changes persona and he becomes this snotty-nosed, wimpy government official right in front of her eyes, she is floored. So I have a lot of fun with him being able to take on disguises.
And moving forward within the series, how do you kind of already have things... how things are maybe going to cultivate with, you know, Madison and Hunter, and how maybe these things are going to go forward?
I have, at least I want to, but as I said, Madison has changed my mind for me as to where things go in the past, so I'm not sure that she'll follow my will in the future, but I do. He happens to have a son her age and a grandson, and they get pulled into the picture. And her mother is a widow, so she gets pulled in the picture, and her mother is his age. So there's all kinds of dynamics in there. And there's actually a pretty deep, dark secret in Hunter's past about someone that he, I don't want to give too much away, but someone
right.
that he killed.
So you're going to kind of bring these things along slowly, and people
yeah.
are going to know the characters and kind of get to know them as you kind of continue forward here in the series.
Absolutely. I've got multiple books in my mind. I want it to, the best authors in a series, when you get several books down, you see that the characters have evolved and grown. I love series characters, but I do get impatient when you're 10 or 12 books in and the characters are making the same mistakes they made in the beginning. And they really, you could be at the first book again because nobody's grown or changed at all.
Now, the one thing that I just noticed, and I'm just going to kind of bring this up because I just happened to notice who your publisher was. And we had Deborah Goldstein on earlier, and you guys have the same exact publisher. I had no idea. You have two different publicists, but you had the same exact publisher.
I didn't know that.
Was writing a mystery series, and she said that Five Star Publishing is no longer going to do mystery series. Did you know that?
Yeah, I found that out, and that was very frustrating, I'll admit, because this is my first book, so I better do well enough that I can interest a publisher in the second book in the series. So that was, you know, but I'll figure it out. Life's full of hardships. This isn't the worst thing that's happened to me in my life. I'll work it.
Well, like I told Deborah, I told her off the air, and I would have told you off the air, but I didn't. You need to email me, if you could, please, at editor@suspensemagazine.com. So just email me, and we'll take it from there further. And I just remind everybody, you can go to KennedyQuinn.com for more information on this book, The Last Best Lie, the first book in the Madison McKinney mystery series. And, you know, when you were going to go ahead and bring this out, and it was very easy, of course, because of your background, you're like, okay, I'm going to have a character that not really mirrors maybe what you do, but is very in tune with what you do in the real life. But it's the other side of it, because now you're going to get into an area that you might not be familiar with. You know, a lot of police procedural, a lot of those other things. How much research or reading did you have to do to kind of get that other side of it, outside of the Madison part, to bring in that aspect of the books?
Again, really good question. It's a combination of things. I was in the military myself for many years. That's how I got enough money to get an education. So I knew a lot of military cops and a lot of Marines. And while that's different, that's still procedure-wise, that there's a lot that's similar. Plus, I know a few policemen around here, and I've walked into some local police precincts and just asked them to talk to me. I actually took a online course in private investigation, and I've got an appointment in a couple weeks to speak with a private investigator and just, you know, learn how I can. So at some level, it's research, like everything else.
Right. And going forward, you know, did you kind of look back, and every author has, I mean, it's no big deal, but every author kind of looks back maybe at their book and realizes maybe mistakes that they made and things that they want to kind of make stronger or make tighter, and they go in for book two, you know, like with anything. Did you kind of do the same thing, and now when people are going to maybe see your next book, they're going to maybe see a different, not a different Kennedy Quinn writing, but they're going to notice some changes that you did make from the first book?
So I don't have to notice changes, but I will say something I want to start emphasizing a little more, and it actually reflects back a little on the question you asked a moment ago. While Kennedy came from a world of elite academics, I come from what would, in my time, would have been called poor white trash. We were always one step ahead of the bill collectors. There were drugs, alcohol, people going to jail a lot in my childhood. So I lived the life she's getting involved with now. And some of the characters in my first book and in the second book are some of those more gritty, real characters who don't make smart choices and are not nice people. And what I want to do as I go through these characters in the future is to sort of expose her more to a rougher side of life where people aren't always reasonable and logical. And I wondered sometimes if I made enough of that in the first book. So maybe I didn't push that raw aspect enough. It is something I want to expose her to in the future. Does that answer your question?
Awesome. It does, you know, because, you know, I always tell people, of course, you know, writing the book is the easy part. You know, the hard part is getting people to, you know, to buy it. You know, that's always the more difficult part. And so being able to understand, you know, who you are as an author and being able to realize that, yes, you know, you did have there are some things that you always have to work on because no book is perfect. I mean, you know, everybody has, you know, every book has their, you know, their flaws and things like that. So to be able to understand and kind of move forward is always a good thing. And to know and people see you grow, they see the changes that you're doing, whether or not, like I always say, whether it's dialogue or scene setting or whatever you're doing, you know, in description, you know, it just goes a little bit, it goes a little bit beyond that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will totally echo the fact that I have put almost as much work into trying to sell the book, especially as a first-time author, as I ever did into writing it. But you know what? I got to tell you, people like you help.
Thank you.
You're proud of what you're doing. It's great.
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, I want to kind of give you the last little 30 seconds here because we run out of time. So kind of let everybody know, you know, where they can follow you and where the best place is to find out more information about what you have.
Fantastic. Go to my website, kennedyquinn.com. I'm also on Facebook, which you can access from my website. And I will say the last thing is I sponsor a $200 a month scholarship for young women, men, and minorities in the STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics disciplines, trying to help them get to school. And that's on my website, too. So if you know any, you know, young women, minorities, or economically disadvantaged people who could use a little bit of extra help getting that book bought or whatever is necessary to get through their science career, send them to my website, kennedyquinn.com, and maybe they can do a blog and win a little money to help them get through school.
Awesome. Awesome stuff, Kennedy. Thank you so much for coming on. It has been an absolute joy to speak with you. Hope to speak with you very soon in the future. So we will talk with you soon.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that is author Kennedy Quinn, and the book is called The Last Best Lie. It is available now. It came out in February, so it's available now. Go on Amazon, buy it. Kindle's $3.99. Pop it in there. You're a fan of, you know, who was not a fan of MacGyver and who was not a fan of those kinds of shows? And wrap that up now in a mystery series. It's fascinating, and it's definitely very entertaining. And that's all you can ask for from a book is to just to be entertained. And when you read it, you just have that smile on your face, and you're just kind of like, wow, that was, you know, that was a great, however long it takes you to, you know, read a 300-page book, you're like, that was just a great time that I spent. Well, we want to go ahead and say, again, thank you to all the guests that were on here, Deborah Goldstein, Adam Mitzner, and then Kennedy Quinn. It's great to be able to speak with all of them and to bring them to you. Again, follow us. Go to iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, and you can get all of those right into your listening device. KensingtonBooks.com, make sure that you check them out. And we will see you all in 2 weeks for the next Inside Edition. Jeff and I will be back on Monday with Beyond the Cover, and I will be on tomorrow with One-on-One, and I got two guests for that. So a lot of information, a lot of stuff we got coming to you. So until then, everybody, we just want to say, of course, thanks so much, and keep reading. Have a good day. Bye-bye.